Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. In 1851, Herman Melville published what many literary scholars consider the quintessential American novel, Moby Dick. As our guest this week, Nathaniel Philbrook, explains, however, the novel is not entirely fictional. And Dr. America joins us this week with his thoughts on the American holiday of Thanksgiving. But before we get to our guests, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. Two unprecedented events occurred in presidential history this week. On November 5, 1940, President Franklin D. Roosevelt was elected to a third term, upsetting a two-term tradition established since the presidency of George Washington. 4 years later, on November 7th, Roosevelt was elected again, establishing the current record of having been elected president four times. In 1940, Wendell Willkie campaigned against Roosevelt's New Deal, but lost. In 1944, in the midst of World War II, rather than switch to Thomas Dewey, the American people chose to stick with the familiar, invoking the old slogan, "Don't change horses in midstream." But change they would when, 5 months later, after 12 years of leading the nation through the dark times of the Great Depression and World War II, Franklin Roosevelt succumbed to a cerebral hemorrhage. With passage of the 22nd Amendment to the U.S. Constitution in 1951, American presidents were barred from being elected to that office more than twice. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, local historians in Concordia, Kansas, are creating a memorial out of what remains of a prisoner of war camp that housed captured Germans and Italians during World War II. The camp was just one of about 150 scattered across the country, most in the Midwest, that housed more than 400,000 enemy soldiers. In operation from 1943 to 1945, the camp's population peaked at over 5,000 inmates, equaling the town's civilian population. All that remains of the camp is a restored limestone guard lookout and part of a water tower. Routinely accepted statistics die hard. The Korean War is a case in point. On monuments and in textbooks across the country, the total number of American deaths due to the Korean War is recorded at 54,246. Historian Alan Millett has no qualms about the well-established battle figures of 33,686. He has questioned, however, the estimate of other deaths, often the result of epidemics or vehicular accidents unrelated to the war, which is set at over 20,000. Millett's suspicions prompted the Defense Department to take another look at its records, and it lowered the official figure for American deaths as a result of the Korean War to 36,516, a reduction of nearly 18,000. This is Talking History. There are no more dramatic scenes in American literature than the final confrontation between Captain Ahab and Moby Dick in the novel by Herman Melville. As Nathaniel Philbrook tells us this week, the scene was based on a real-life incident well known to the people of the 19th century. Here to talk with Philbrook about that historical incident is Talking History's Fred Nielsen.
The story of the whale ship Essex, rammed by a whale, it sank in the Pacific Ocean in 1820, was as well known in the 19th century as the sinking of the Titanic is in ours. Nearly every American child read about the disaster in school, and it inspired the climactic scene of Herman Melville's Moby Dick. With me today is Nathaniel Philbrick, the author of In the Heart of the Sea, The Tragedy of the Whale Ship Essex. He is the director of the Egan Institute of Maritime Studies and a research fellow at the Nantucket Historical Association. In the Heart of the Sea has received the National Book Award. Nathaniel Philbrick, welcome.
It's great to be here.
The sinking of the Essex seems to have captivated 19th century Americans, school children and Melville alike. Exactly what happened to the ship and its crew?
Well, you know, it's the event that inspired the climax, but a lot of things happened on the Essex after that. It began in November 20th, 1820, right in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, right on the equator, when a huge sperm whale, 85 feet long, attacked the whale ship Essex and rammed it not once but twice. Didn't sink the ship, but it disabled it so that it filled up with water and capsized, forcing the men to take to their three very small, just 25 feet long, whale boats. and they were in the middle of the Pacific, and they had a decision to make where to go next. And they had enough provisions to last 2 months, they felt. And the natural thing would have been to go with the trade winds to the islands to the west, the Marquesas, the Society Islands. But they had heard rumors of cannibals. So instead, they decided to sail for South America, 3,000 miles away and upwind. And they figured if everything went right, they could do it in under their 60-day time limit. But instead of everything going right, everything would go wrong, and they would start suffering from dehydration, starvation. And in what is really the central and terrible irony of the Essex disaster, they would be forced to eat the bodies of their dead shipmates and enact the very fate they had sailed all that distance to escape.
You note that the first four sailors to be eaten were African Americans. Mm-hmm. Can that have been a coincidence?
Well, you know, it's been sort of the dirty secret of the Essex, I think. And one of the things when I began work on this book was I wanted to explore, you know, what was going on. What were the demographics of death here? Because there were six of the 20 sailors were black. And as you just said, the first four to die and be eaten were black, and what was going on there. There's no evidence of any kind of favoritism when it came to the distribution of rations, and yet what I did find out was that prior to the sinking, all the African-American sailors were in the forecastle of the ship up forward, where typically on whale ships in this period, you just got fed less and lower quality food. And so that going into this disaster, they would have been in worse shape than the white sailors. And as any expert in a survival situation will tell you, if you go into a starvation situation, your health prior to that is a big factor. The other thing is that leadership is very important in a survival situation. And there were three whale boats, and they were really autonomous entities to a certain extent. And second mate Matthew Joy was apparently ill even before the ordeal began. He may have been suffering from tuberculosis. In any event, he was not in good shape to provide strong leadership. And in fact, the men on board his whale boat had to nurse him. And instead of being inspired and led by their officer, they had to take care of him. So the men on this whale boat were in trouble from the beginning, and four of the six blacks would be placed on Matthew Joy's boat. So I think those two factors had a lot to do with how things would play out on the Essex.
You use words like brutal and desensitizing to describe the whaling business. And I must say, having read your book, the work sounds hard, dangerous, and often disgusting.
Yeah.
What was it like?
Well, you know, it was some of the hardest, most appalling, and difficult work I think men have had to endure. Because not only were you on a whale ship that would take you out for 2 to 3 years at a time to the other side of the world, being fed very little, but then you had to kill this whale, which is a very dangerous process. You had to stab it with this huge lance on this bobbing boat beside this 60-ton creature that could send you to your death with just a flick of its tail. And then after killing this creature, after getting drenched in blood, you dragged it to the whale ship, where it took about a week to rip off the blubber from its corpse, hack this blubber into manageable pieces, and then boil it down into oil. And they used the blubber of the whale itself to feed these fires, which sent up this just dreadful, black, sooty, smelly smoke that coated all the men. They would work almost all day, all night for a week, disposing of, translating the blubber into oil, and then they'd have to do it again. A typical whale ship had to kill between 40 and 50 whales before it could head back to Nantucket.
You mentioned that the rookies, the new sailors who haven't been in a whale ship before, are sort of disgusted that they change their clothes the first opportunity they can,
yeah,
and the experienced hands keep the same clothes on.
Right. Well, you know, you had all your possessions had to fit in your sea chest. So you just had a limited amount of clothing. And what a veteran whaleman knew was that you saved one pair of clothes during trying out because you just didn't have enough to spare to use them. But the fact of the matter was, one day of trying out a whale, you're covered with blood and oil and smoke. And a lot of people had allergic reactions on their skin, and so the natural thing to do would be to take off those dirty clothes, clean yourself, go to sleep, and then go at it again the next day. And that's what the green hands, the new people to whaling, did. But then they ended up ruining their clothes the next day. And what the veterans did is they realized, hey, it's not worth cleaning up. You just stay in your dirty, disgusting clothes. You stay dirty. You catch a few winks down below, and then you go out again, and then only after you're done boiling out this whale do you change your clothes.
As hard and dangerous as the work was, one wonders if it was profitable, and for whom. Was it profitable for ship owners and especially for sailors?
Yeah. You know, before there was petroleum, before John D. Rockefeller made his millions, there was Nantucket whale oil. It was the petroleum of its day. And Nantucket was the mobile oil headquarters for what was at this point a global business. And Nantucket was one of the wealthiest communities in the country because of whaling. And it was the whale oil merchants who didn't have to leave the comforts of their mansions on Nantucket who made most of the money. The captain on a whale ship made good money, 3 to 6 times what a captain on a merchant vessel would make. But for half the crew, who were just common seamen, whaling was no means for wealth. It was the lowest rung of the maritime ladder. It was something people who wanted to escape either unemployment or a bad police record resorted to. And so you had a real two-track system where if you were from Nantucket and talented, you had a real future. As a captain, you could look to retire at age 40 and live off your investments. But if you weren't from Nantucket and you were going on a whale ship just as a last resort, it was 3 years of misery.
You suggest in your book that the story of the Essex raises several issues, and you mentioned among the possibilities race and class, questions of leadership and of humans' relationship to nature. Could you elaborate on those things?
Yeah, you know, the one thing I wanted to do with the story was to make it something more than an old sailing yarn. I wanted to really point out that the story of the Essex was an important part of American history. This was something that was a lot more than a survival tale. And part of the issues that come out of this are issues of leadership. For example, the Essex had a first-time captain, Captain George Pollard, only 28 years old. And in the crucial decision to sail for South America rather than to sail with the trade winds to the islands to the west, initially he decided what seems like the natural thing to do today, sail for Tahiti. They would have gotten there in plenty of time, given the amount of rations they had. And yet, his mates disagreed with him. They were fearful of cannibals, and they talked him out of it. And usually, the captain's word is law. But Pollard had what we would call, in today's buzzword, a consensual mode of leadership, rather than an authoritarian mode of leadership. And so I try to analyze the leadership issues there. And the other thing I wanted to look at was, you know, how did the men's suffering influence the decisions they were making once they had decided on this course? So I looked at a lot of research into starvation, into dehydration. I looked at what psychologists have learned from the concentration camps in World War II, and tried to apply this to what was occurring on the whale boats after the sinking of the Essex.
How many of the men survived altogether?
Yeah, there were 20 that left the whale ship, and they would stumble across an island a month into it. And unfortunately, there was not enough wildlife to support all the men. However, 3 of the men would decide to stay, and the other 17 would get in their whale boats and head out for South America, still 3,000 miles away. And so out of those whale boats, one whale boat would be lost and never heard from again. But of the 2 whale boats that would be rescued, only 5 would make it out alive, all from Nantucket. They would then send a rescue ship to the island, Henderson Island, which is part of the Pitcairn group. Pitcairn is the island where the Bounty mutineers eventually ended up. And those three on that island would be rescued. So of the 20, a total of 8 survived the Essex, and incredibly, all 8 would return to the sea.
There's the destruction of the men that, of course, is a main part of the story, part of the narrative drive, but it's part of a larger context of destruction as well, the destruction of the whales, as well as other parts of nature. I noticed as I was reading your book that Nantucketers seem to have been transgressing nature's limits almost from the start. They exhausted
Absolutely.
Their soil and the local yeah. whale population.
Yeah, there's a huge ecological tale here, I think. And as you said, Nantucketers from the very beginning of the island settlement back in 1659 really had very little regard for what they were doing to their environment. They almost immediately on Nantucket over-cultivated the island, reducing the soil to sand. And so that, you know, farming wasn't going to lead them anywhere, so they went out whaling, and they killed off all the whales in their vicinity, and requiring them to get into larger ships, go chase the whale to every corner of the globe. That's why they ended up going around the Horn into the Pacific. So everywhere they went, they were just absolutely relentless in pursuing the whale. And, one of the things they did in a typical whaling voyage was to stop at the Galapagos Islands to round up hundreds of Galapagos tortoises, which they used for provisions. The Galapagos tortoise could live for a year and a half without any food and water, so it was the perfect provisioning device for these men. And while they were on what they called Charles Island in the Galapagos, one of the men, as a prank, lit a fire that ended up burning up the whole island, and it was a blackened wasteland by the time they left it. So there's a real ecological side to this, and these men were just relentlessly chasing the dollar and fishing out the waters that were that they depended on for their livelihood. And it's a story that unfortunately is being played out today. We see it in the fishing fleets. There just are not the resources to support the levels that men have pushed nature to.
Well, you imply that, in a sense, Nantucket is a kind of microcosm. You write at one point, relentlessly acquisitive, technologically advanced, with a religious sense of its own destiny, Nantucket was, in 1821, what America would become.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, and I think people don't understand today. You know, if they know about Nantucket, they think of it as a resort where you go to get away from it all. Well, Nantucket in the early 19th century was an emblem to this nation, which was a very young nation, which in the early 19th century was really a coastal nation. You know, these were states that were stuck to the Atlantic coastline, and Nantucket was shown this little commonwealth of its own on an island. Ralph Waldo Emerson would go out to Nantucket and describe it as the nation of Nantucket. And what it was doing was showing this young nation that was still trying to figure out where it was going to go, how it could conduct itself as a world power, how it could that its dominion was not just the land between the Atlantic and the Pacific. Its dominion could be the entire globe, the Pacific Ocean, which is, the world's largest ocean. And, this was a time when America really had two frontiers. It was not just the West. If it had a primary frontier, it was the sea. It was the sea that every American shared an experience of in coming to the country. And before there was the cowboy and there was the buffalo, there was the Nantucket whaleman pursuing the sperm whale.
In just the minute or so we have left, I'm curious if you could elaborate on the influence that the Essex had on Melville. What do you make of it?
Well, the Essex was a story that a lot of people knew about in the early 19th century. First mate Owen Chase would write a narrative that would become widely distributed, and a abridged version of it would appear in McGuffey's Eclectic Fourth Reader, kind of the Dick and Jane of its day. So you didn't have to live in Nantucket or a maritime community to know about the Essex. And one of these people was Herman Melville, who was born within days of the Essex leaving Nantucket for the last time. He would become a whaleman because he just couldn't make a living doing much of anything else, heard about the Essex, and at one point, while he was out there in the Pacific, they came across a Nantucket whale ship that contained Owen Chase's son, who gave Melville a copy of his father's narrative. Melville read it, would record later that it had an extraordinary influence on him, and a decade later would write Moby Dick.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
I've been visiting with Nathaniel Philbrick, the author of In the Heart of the Sea, The Tragedy of the Whale Ship Essex.
And if you work with the rod and the reel, tell my wife I am trolling Atlantis, and I still have my hands on the wheel.
For our site of the week, we've chosen the center of the American whaling industry in the 19th century, Nantucket, Massachusetts, and the place in the town where you might begin your tour of that historic community. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The few surviving materials from the whale ship Essex are on display at the Whaling Museum on the island of Nantucket. The museum contains many exhibits illustrating how whales were harpooned and how they were processed for oil at sea. It also contains the skeleton of a 40-foot finback whale and much more. The Whaling Museum is just one of many sites featured by the Nantucket Historical Association. The 48-square-mile island is home to the nation's largest concentration of 18th-century buildings, miles of pristine beaches, and one of the largest cranberry bogs in the region. The island, located about 20 miles off the coast of Cape Cod, is rich in history and is a popular resort community as well.
November brings us Thanksgiving Day, a national holiday established in 1863 and a harvest ritual dating back to colonial days. Today, in the dining room of the magnificent but wholly imaginary American Studies Museum, Dr. America, actually Professor James Farrell of St. Olaf College, is trying to complexify this feast of gratitude and gluttony for a group of visitors. Let's listen in.
As you might expect, the 4th of July is Dr. America's favorite holiday. But Thanksgiving is a close second, not because of the pilgrims or because it's a certified national holiday, but because it hasn't yet become obscenely commercialized. For the most part, the malls are still closed on Thanksgiving, and we don't yet feel the compulsion to give each other gifts. There may be gluttony on Thanksgiving, but there isn't much greed. Properly understood, Thanksgiving reminds us of values that provide links both to the past and potentially to a sustainable future. Thanksgiving means literally the giving of thanks. Thanks are an expression of gratitude and appreciation for the goodness in our lives. The word thanks comes from the same root as the word think. So if we think about it, we can say that thinking leads to thanks. On this holiday, we offer these thanks primarily to God for the grace of creation and of care. We may routinely say grace at dinner, but this time we mean it comprehensively. We see, as we should see every day, the amazing grace of creation, the grace of our family and friends. We offer a blessing, which is etymologically, of course, a consecration. We celebrate the holiness of creation, the wholeness of our lives, the health of our bodies and minds and spirits. On Thanksgiving, when we are really thanking, we begin to see that, like Elvis, we all live in Graceland. To some extent, Thanksgiving is a countercultural festival. We spend 364 days a year thinking about competing and acquiring and looking out for number one. But Thanksgiving reminds us that although we normally think of ourselves as living in a market economy, in fact, we inhabit a gift economy. The best things in life are free, not because they're worthless, but because they're gifts. So we offer thanks to God, but we also offer thanks to our fellow human beings. We thank the family and friends who gather with us for festivities, and we thank them as proxies for all the human beings and institutions that have had a hand in our good fortune. These thanks are especially important in America because they remind us that we are not self-made men and women. We are both creatures of God and creators of each other. On Thanksgiving, we are also thankful for the ideas and institutions that literally make our lives possible and pleasurable. We understand, if only for a day, how much our good fortune stems from the good in society and not just from the goods of society. Thanksgiving, therefore, also reminds us of our obligations. The thanks we give for the gifts we have received are balanced, we hope, by the thanks we receive for the gifts we ourselves have given. Each of us is literally a gifted person. And because our gifts come from a gift economy, we have an obligation to be givers. A prayer that Dr. America clipped from the newspaper a few years ago captures this idea well. Dear God, we thank you for food and remember the hungry. We thank you for health and remember the sick. We thank you for friends and remember the friendless. We thank you for freedom and remember the enslaved. May these remembrances stir us to service, that your gifts to us may be used for others. Amen. From the American Studies Museum, this is Dr. America, thinking twice about thanks and giving in American life.
Dr. America's monthly commentary comes to us courtesy of WCAL Radio in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota. And this is Talking History. And finally, turning to our list of coming attractions, on November 21st, the History Channel will go in search of Atlantis. For over 2,000 years, the world's greatest adventurers, explorers, and thinkers have traveled the globe in a quest to find the lost city of Atlantis. This two-hour special continues that search, not just for its physical location, but for the truth behind this enduring myth. Using the same type of special effects that brought Rome back to life in Gladiator, In Search of Atlantis recreates the lost city's islands, harbors, palaces, and temples in the moment of destruction when it disappeared from the earth. The world's foremost Atlantis experts offer a commentary on why we continue to be fascinated by its elusive charms. Be sure to check your local listings for the exact showtime of this History Channel special. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University and the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Creighton, visit the university's website at creighton.edu. Information on the Organization of American Historians is available at oah.org. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
I am the loom.